Even Franklin D. Roosevelt, who had a stroke, there is a paper out there which shows his blood pressure during the conference at Yalta at the end of the Second World War. And it's like his blood pressure was 200, 230, 240.
Wow.
No wonder he had a stroke.
Show about medicine
proven to lower your blood pressure.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos,
and the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're gonna look at the evidence behind medical topics, and the show is called...
wait. No, I want to say it.
I want to say it.
I want to say it. I came up with it. It's the body of evidence. It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
We are joined by Dr. Swapnil Hiranath. He is a staff nephrologist, i.e. a kidney doctor, at the Ottawa Hospital. He is also an associate professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa and an associate scientist in the Clinical Epidemiology Program at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute. On top of being a physician, Dr. Hiranath has a master's degree in public health from the Harvard School of Public Health and is a specialist in hypertension. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and glad to talk about something I'm quite passionate about.
Indeed. So just to set the stage, so we are going to be talking about chronotherapy, about blood pressure medication, and about the challenges of doing medical research. And I want to say up front, if you, dear listener, if you do not take blood pressure medication, or if you have no interest in this, I still think that you will find this interesting. And I will do my best to make sure that this doesn't turn into a super nerdy discussion between Chris and Dr. Hiranath, because it has a very real possibility of turning into that.
And I wish you the best of luck in that endeavor.
So let's remember that most of our audience is not made up of physicians. So I just want to begin, like, Chris, why don't you tell us why you have been harassing me about this for about a year, why you find this topic so fascinating?
Because the more you dig into it, the more you realize how absurd some of the controversy is. Because it's a fundamental question. High blood pressure is a very common problem. And when you should take your medication is a question a lot of people have. And, you know, doing this right is important. And the whole issue with Hygieia, which we're going to get into, is that we need to be sure that the study is real. And the question at the core of it is what you're reading in the scientific literature, you know, actually true, or is it a complete fabrication? And you would think, because we do a lot of critique of studies, like, well, you can think of it this way, you can look at it this way. This is a much more fundamental question. Is the study actually, was it actually done as described? And if that's not true, if people can just do anything and say the opposite, then we have a much bigger problem in terms of scientific accuracy and scientific fraud, and sort of dealing with this is, I think, critically important, because it undermines the entire practice of science.
All right, so now we've laid out the stakes of this discussion. So Dr. Hiranath, I'm going to throw a very softball at you. What is high blood pressure? What is happening inside the body to cause high blood pressure?
So high blood pressure is, you know, we measure blood pressure previously with a mercury manometer, and nowadays we have these electronic gizmos that, you know, you press a button, they inflate a bladder, a cuff around your arm, and they spit out a couple of numbers. And these numbers, we have known about high blood pressure for a few centuries, blood pressure for a few centuries. And roughly since the mid-50s or so, we have found out that lowering this blood pressure is good for you. And that high blood pressure is bad. So when the blood pressure is high, this is the pressure inside your blood vessels, inside your arteries, and the heart is pumping blood to all your blood vessels, to all your organs. So if the blood pressure goes up, so if it is higher than what it should be, your heart has to pump harder. The heart muscle thickens, and eventually it could fail. But also this high blood pressure is felt by your brain, by your kidneys, by your eyes, and a lot of bad things can happen. As to why people have high blood pressure, it could be many, many different factors. So, you know, I'm a kidney doctor, so kidney disease can cause high blood pressure. But most commonly in our society, We think that there are a couple of reasons that are at play here. One is that as people get older, you know, your blood vessels, your arteries, they change, they become stiffer. And that's a major contributor. The other thing is that our diet is not the same as what we used to in the prehistorical times. We eat a lot of processed food, but chiefly we eat less fruits and vegetables, and we eat a lot of sodium. So these things contribute to high blood pressure. And apart from that, there could be, you know, specific reasons. There could be hormonal issues or specific diseases that contribute to high blood pressure. But these are the common things that cause high blood pressure. So we treat high blood pressure because by treating high blood pressure, we are able to reduce someone's risk of getting all those badness that stem from having high blood pressure for many years.
I think what's fascinating about this whole story is that the idea that you should even treat high blood pressure is a relatively recent realization. And for a long time, throughout, you know, a fair portion of the 20th century, there was actually a lot of resistance to the idea that you should treat high blood pressure. One of my most favorite quotes, and I use this slide when I give talks, was John Jay. He was an English physician. I can't remember when he said this, but it was certainly early in the 20th century. And the quote goes something like, "The only danger to a man with high blood pressure is that eventually some fool will try to lower it."
Yeah.
And there was a very real belief that you needed high blood pressure as you got older to push the blood through the arteries. And that's why you still sometimes see it referred to as essential hypertension, to differentiate it from secondary hypertension, which is caused by, you know, one of these hormonal problems or a tumor in the adrenal glands that's producing hormones or something, or sleep apnea.
Essential, because you need it. It's essential for you.
Well, that's what they thought. But of course, that's wrong, because you don't need it. And that's why you've seen the criteria for lowering blood pressure get progressively lower over the course of decades. My other favorite slide is that I sometimes use, I forget which trial it was, but there was one trial, one of the famous hypertension trials, that when they categorized mild hypertension as a blood pressure of 180, which today would send people screaming to the emergency room because, oh my God, it's a catastrophe. But there was a time when a blood pressure of 180 was considered mild hypertension. And now we consider that almost severe, almost like emergency level stuff, because a normal blood pressure is 120 for people who need a frame of reference. So
exactly. Mm-hmm. So if I could interrupt, the trial that he's talking about is probably the Veterans Affairs trials from the published in the early 60s. And these were young and otherwise, you know, healthier men, but their blood pressures were like 200 over 120. So the diastolic was 120. And they were debating whether these people should even be treated or not. And that was a very small trial because they lowered the blood pressure a little bit, and there was a dramatic reduction, you know, in stroke and death. Franklin D. Roosevelt, who had a stroke, there is a paper out there which shows his blood pressure during the conference at Yalta at the end of the Second World War. And it's like his blood pressure was 200, 230, 240. No wonder he had a stroke, right? And this is 1945, and people were, you know, we didn't have good means of lowering blood pressure. So blood pressure medications weren't great at that time. But it was also debated whether we should lower blood pressure at all.
So blood pressure, it's two numbers. Dr. Hiramath, what are those numbers? What do they mean?
So there is the systolic and the diastolic blood pressure. And Christopher, as a cardiologist, can give a better explanation of what that means. But previously, you know, as a person who is treating blood pressure, it was previously thought that it is a lower number that is more important. And these days, of course, we focus more on the upper number. But I would say both numbers are important. The systole, the upper number, is when the heart is pumping blood out. So that's higher. That's where the normal range we say is up to 120 for that one. And when the heart is relaxing, that's the lower number. And that's, roughly up to 80 is supposed to be acceptable. I don't know if Chris wants to say something more about that.
Chris, does he pass a test?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. It's basically when the heart pumps, the blood pressure increases. And then when the heart relaxes, the blood pressure decreases. And the reason why it doesn't drop to zero is because your blood vessels, being elastic structures, are able to sort of expand hand and absorb some of the pressure and then release it back. So that's why when you're younger, your blood pressure tends to be more regulated. And as we get older, the high number goes up, the low number goes down, and sort of the pulse pressure, the difference between those numbers starts to widen. And so you have a lot of older people who are like, my blood pressure is so low, it's like 140 over 60. And they're like, that's low, right? I'm like, well, no, because when you take the average, which is what you're supposed to do. We're supposed to actually take the mean blood pressure, which is one third of the big number plus two thirds of the little number. In practice, we don't always do it because, you know, math is hard and people don't have a calculator at hand. But it's interesting. And a lot of my older patients, again, because of it used to be thought that it was the lower number that was most important. And I have a lot of patients who are like hyper-focused on their lower number. And they're like, yeah, but this. I'm like, no, don't worry about it. No, but I heard that that's the... And I have a lot of them who refer to the lower number as the heart's blood pressure. Like, that's a thing people say. And it's because they were told, no, it's the lower number that matters. And it's like, no, not really. That drops with time as you get older. And you sort of learn to look at both and take the average, quite frankly, which is probably the most accurate way of doing it.
Okay, so we will slowly make our way to chronotherapy into this Hygieia trial that you mentioned. But just first of all, we have anti-hypertensive drugs, right, to take care of high blood pressure. How do they work? What do they do inside the body?
So there are many different classes of anti-hypertensive or blood pressure lowering drugs, to be simple. And as I mentioned previously, we didn't have good drugs. So, you know, in the Veterans Affairs trials, I talked about they used drugs called reserpine and guanethidine. These are drugs that have so many side effects that we no longer use them. There are the common classes of drugs we use. One is the calcium channel blockers. They usually end with a dipine, such as amlodipine or nifedipine or felodipine. They are what we call as calcium channel blockers. So calcium is required for the blood vessels to contract. That means to become narrow. And these drugs block that. So the blood vessels relax. And, you know, if the blood vessels relax, means they become larger, the pressure will be lower. That's one big class of drugs. The other big other two classes of drugs we use commonly are called ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers. So they work through hormones made in the kidney, and they block the effect of the hormones. And these hormones, again, cause something similar. These hormones cause the blood vessels to become narrower, and these drugs block that effect. The last group of drugs that we use commonly are diuretics or water pills. So often hydrochlorothiazide, chlorthalidone, spironolactone. These drugs make your kidney pee out more salt. So as I said, you know, sodium is important and eating a lot of sodium contributes to high blood pressure. So these drugs work the opposite way. So they make your kidney put out more sodium. They also have an effect on the blood vessel relaxation. And we don't always know exactly how these drugs work, but they also lower blood pressure. So these are the common, we call them first line drugs. But apart from that, we also have many second line drugs and third line drugs. We choose drugs based on the on the safety profile, right? So the dipines and the ACE inhibitors, which end with the prills, and the ARBs, which end with the sartan name. So these are drugs which have a very good safety profile. So they lower blood pressure, but they don't cause a lot of severe or serious adverse or side effects. When we go to the second line and third line drugs, their safety becomes, you know, they have more side effects, let's say. And lastly, we also look at clinical trials. So it's not that this is a pill, it lowers your blood pressure, that is important. But this is a pill, it lowers your blood pressure, but it also decreases the risk of stroke, say, or the risk of heart failure, or the risk of kidney failure. That's really what is important, right? You don't want to treat a number, you actually want to prevent bad things that happen from that number being elevated.
So the final piece to this introduction is pharmacokinetics. I want to ask the two of you to tell me a little bit about pharmacokinetics, which is how our body interacts with and metabolizes a drug, and why is it that certain drugs only stay in our body for a short time while others stay for a much longer period of time?
So if I could go first, it's that, and we often, the pharmaceutical industry actually designs drugs to take advantage of these phenomena. If when you take a pill, it goes into your stomach and your intestines, it gets absorbed. Everything that goes into your gut firstly goes through the liver. So the liver actually, you know, it treats any substance, especially any foreign substance coming out as, you know, hey, is this good or bad? And a bunch of it is broken down there and it actually doesn't even enter your bloodstream. If it passes that first through the liver, then it circulates in your blood and your body, you know, takes up as its wear and tear and cleaning up the liver, kidneys, other organs. They take care of the drug and the levels slowly fall. Some drugs, so the amlodipine that I'm talking about, for example, it will go, it will get absorbed from your gut, it will pass, some of it will be taken up by the liver, the rest of it will be in the blood circulation, and that's where it's going to act. It's going to act on the blood vessels, relaxing them. So it will be taken up by the cells to cause the relaxation, and the circulating amlodipine will then be taken up by the liver and the kidney, mostly by the liver, and it will disappear. So it has a certain duration of action. For example, for amlodipine, it remains in the circulation for, you know, more than 12 to 18 hours, and the effect on the blood pressure is going to be even longer. So it's what we call as a long-acting blood pressure pill. So if you take amlodipine today in the morning, it's going to be around in your system at least until the next day. And often, you know, amlodipine in particular is a very long-acting drug, so it will be lowering your blood pressure even for day 2 and day 3. On the other hand, there are other drugs like hydralazine. It's a very short-acting drug, so it will reduce blood pressure very fast when you take it. So, you know, half an hour later after taking the drug, your blood pressure may go down by 10 or 20 millimeters, but by 4 hours, it's gone because your liver is really good at mopping up the hydralazine that is there in your system, and the blood pressure comes up again.
I think it's also important to realize is that a lot of the older medications that were used in some of these historic trials from, you know, 20, maybe 30 years ago, tended to be short-acting medications that you had to take twice or three times a day to be effective. Whereas now, most of the medications that patients are prescribed are long-acting medications that are once daily formulations. And this is going to become an important point later, where to a certain extent, people are kind of debating old issues that are no longer relevant because the issue of timing is maybe more relevant when you have a short-acting medication and less relevant when you have a long-acting medication, which is going to stay in your body for over 24 hours sometimes, regardless of what you do. So, you know, why are some drugs short-acting and why are some long-acting? Well, they're made that way. It's how they're designed and how they're metabolized by the body. It's sometimes just as straightforward as that.
And we have actually gone, as Chris alluded, with time, because it's harder to remember to take a pill 2 times a day or 3 times a day, right? One of them, you know, if it's hydralazine, you have to take it in the middle of the day a couple of times. If you're at work, you're not going to remember to do that. And that's sort of the reason. There's a lot of research showing that patient adherence is greater when a pill is given once a day. So, you know, you wake up in the morning, you're brushing your teeth, you take all your pills. So that is something that has been deliberately done to have longer acting pills that you can take once a day, which make life easy for everyone.
So when it comes to blood pressure medication, there is an intense debate that is happening, and it's over this concept of chronotherapy, which I would like you to define and to tell us who are the players in this debate and what do they believe?
So if you could allow me to digress a little bit before we talk about chronotherapy.
Absolutely.
At the heart of this is the idea, the concept of circadian rhythms. So, you know, your body has an internal clock. You know when to sleep. You know, typically most people fall asleep at a certain time. They wake up at a certain time. You know, things change over the period of the day and night. And that's because we have an internal clock. And the people who actually, you know, describe the biological mechanisms of that in 2017, they were given the Nobel Prize for that. So this is, you know, the circadian rhythm is true. It's a really important biological phenomena. Secondly, how does that relate to blood pressure? Well, even the blood pressure changes in the day and in the night. So even normally, let's say someone's blood pressure is 120 over 80, roughly, it goes up and down, of course, through the day. In the day, when you sleep, you relax, right? You're asleep, there is no stress, your body relaxes, it needs less, you know, less energy, less things going on. So the heart rate goes down and the blood pressure goes down when we sleep. So it may go down by roughly, we know anything more than 10% is said to be normal, but let's say goes down from 120 to 100. And that's a normal phenomena that when you're asleep, your heart rate, your blood pressure goes down. It may be because of many reasons. You know, I said relaxing in lay terms, but there is something called the sympathetic nervous system that goes down and your body is, you know, taking care of maintenance when you're asleep. Mm-hmm. Now, in some people, this does not happen. For example, some people with diabetes, who are overweight or obese, or who have kidney disease or sleep apnea, and a bunch of other conditions, when we measure their blood pressure, we see that it is high in the day, but it remains high at night. So this is something which is really important. And there are a lot of studies that show that, you know, if this is the phenotype or this is the phenomena that is happening, these people have a greater risk of having heart disease, stroke, kidney disease in the future. And it makes sense, right? Like the heart is pumping against the high blood pressure in the day. And maybe, you know, in you and me, it is pumping less hard. So it gets a bit of a break. But in these people whose blood pressure does not dip at night, they have a higher risk of all these bad things happening. So then it would make sense. Let's try to reduce this. How can we reduce blood pressure at night? That's when chronotherapy comes in, specifically for blood pressure. But in general, chronotherapy relates to the fact of, does time of day dosing of any medication or any therapy make a difference? You know, does it make a difference if you do something, you know, if you take a pill in the morning versus at night or in the afternoon? So does that have the study of the fact of whether the time of day dosing matters is the field of chronotherapy. And it is a real field. It is. I'm not saying the whole of chronotherapy is junk. And Chris may correct me, but there is some, you know, not very strong data, but there is some data that perhaps cholesterol lowering pills or statins should be taken at night. But for certain some medications, it may make sense that, you know, you take this pill at this time and that pill at that time. The question is, you know, is this valid to do for blood pressure pills, which is the topic of today's discussion?
So Chris, what do you think about chronotherapy?
I think, here's the thing, I understand the rationale behind it, because it's that it's trying to replicate the nighttime dip in blood pressure, which in theory should work. The problem is, does it work in practice? And that's why you have to study it, because anybody can have a good theory. Does it work in practice? And when you look at the data, and when you look at the data overall, it doesn't appear as if it would make a difference. I think it's what's most important is, do we actually treat blood pressure? And I think that's why understanding the historical context is important, because we went from, over the course of a century, not treating blood pressure to actually treating it very effectively. And this little bit of fine-tuning, should we take the pills in morning or night, I don't think is going to make as much of a difference as the quite correct sea change, where we actually now treat high blood pressure rather than ignore it as a problem.
In this debate over when to take the blood pressure medication, in the morning, at night, what are the two camps, and what was this Hygieia trial supposed to do in the context of this debate?
So this group, actually, you know, the big camp, and I would say it's a minority, but because of their spectacular results, it was splashed everywhere. So this is Professor Hermida and his colleagues at a place called Vigo in Spain. They have actually been doing this for quite a while. With blood pressure pills at night. Even before Hygieia, there was something called MAPEC, M-A-P-E-C, though that was in high-risk population and it did not make the news so much. So this is not their first rodeo. They have been talking and doing this for a while. They believe that chronotherapy in blood pressure is very important. And as I said, you know, some of the fact of you know, trying to fix this problem does make some sense. The question is, will it really work? Which is why I agree with Chris that it doesn't make sense that it would work. So they have been doing this for quite a while. And that was the rationale for the Hygieia trial, to give blood pressure medications at bedtime, not just night, but at bedtime, and give that to, you know, randomize it. So give that to half the people at night. And for the other half, give the blood pressure pills in the morning and see what happens to the blood pressure and see if that actually reverses all the increase in heart disease, stroke, kidney failure that I mentioned before. Now, a couple of things to keep in mind. The big one, of course, is that the rest of us believe this will not work because we give long-acting medications. So whether you give amlodipine in the morning or amlodipine at night, it doesn't cause a rapid effect. It's a slow, but it's a long, long, long-acting pill. And there is research showing that whether it, you know, if you give amlodipine in the morning, after, you know, after the first few days, once it reaches a steady state, the blood pressure is very smooth. You don't see a dip, you know, 2 hours after you take the pill. The blood pressure remains, you know, at a certain level throughout the day, throughout the 24-hour period. You don't see ups and downs based on the time of day that the amlodipine is taken. So that's one. The second thing to keep in mind is that that increase in the risk that I talked about, it's roughly a 50% increase in the risk. So let's say the risk of stroke is 10%. People whose blood pressure doesn't fall at night, it goes up to 15%. So it's a 50% risk. So that's the maximum benefit you might see. But that takes into assumption that all the increase in the risk you see is from the high blood pressure and it is mediated through the high blood pressure. So what do I mean by that? It's that, let's say someone has diabetes and they have sleep apnea and they have kidney disease and their blood pressure does not fall at night and they have a stroke. Is the stroke just because of that high blood pressure at night, or is it because of, you know, the reason their blood pressure is high at night is because they have diabetes and because of that they're retaining salt and water, they have sleep apnea, that causes a lot of other bad things to happen. Mm-hmm. So the high blood pressure might be what we call as an epiphenomena. It's that it's a sign of other bad things that are happening, and the other bad things that are underlying that are causing the increased risk of stroke and heart failure. And if we fix the high blood pressure, we are just fixing, you know, what is at the tip of the iceberg, and we are ignoring the everything that is underneath, which is causing this. So for those two reasons, firstly, that it's a long-acting drug. We use mostly long-acting drugs and time of day should not matter. And secondly, that fixing the blood pressure is only fixing a tiny part of the big problem that is there with nocturnal high blood pressure. So that's why the rest of the world, everyone else was like, you know, this does not make a lot of scientific sense. But again, you know, I'm not saying that something that doesn't make sense should not be tested. The right thing to do is then the proof lies in the pudding. So doing a clinical trial, as long as you can get funding and enroll patients and show that this is reasonable to do, would be fine. Do the trial, show that what you're proposing works or does not work.
Chris, what did you think of the results of the Hygieia trial?
I mean, they were very, very impressive and, I mean, huge. To the point of almost incredulity. I mean, you get to a point where you sort of ask yourself, you know, when something is too good to be true, is it? And I think...
Meaning that the timing of when you took the medication had a huge impact.
Huge.
On outcome.
Yes. And I mean, to understand this, I mean, here's the thing. There have been blood pressure trials in the past where you try a new medication versus placebo. And there mm-hmm. were even trials where the medications were given at night rather than during the day. I mean, HOPE, I think, was given at night. And you saw a significant decrease in mortality, which is why that was one of the major trials that sort of motivated guidelines to change to be more aggressive about treating blood pressure. But here you had not testing a medication versus placebo. You had nighttime versus morning medication. And you saw a greater benefit there than you saw versus placebo. Which, like that almost defies logic. That would mean that taking your blood pressure medication in the morning was harmful. It means that it was worse than placebo, and that doesn't make sense. And the other sort of big, and I mean, there's a lot of structural issues with the trial in terms of, you know, the follow-up and the naming and the whole thing. But the other thing, too, is that you saw a decrease in both cardiovascular endpoints, but also in non-cardiovascular endpoints. Then you're like, okay, that doesn't quite make sense. Why would changing the timing of your blood pressure medication decrease your risk of, you know, cancer-related mortality? Like, that doesn't make sense, right? Just conceptually. So it's like, mm-hmm. when you see these huge, huge benefits, I mean, had it been a small benefit, I would have said, okay, maybe there's a... But I mean, to see a huge benefit like this and it affecting so many different and unrelated endpoints, that's, you know, you have to be a little bit skeptical about something like that.
So people were, in theory, randomized to the group that had to take their medication in the morning versus at night. Dr. Hiramath, do you believe that they were indeed randomized?
So not morning and night, but awake and bedtime is how the authors keep stressing. So for whatever reason, let's stick with that terminology.
Sure.
Again, you know, without actually going there and doing an investigation, it is difficult to be conclusive. But this was a trial of over 19,000 patients done out of a small center, one single center, and they had complete follow-up. So when you do a trial, when you take 1,000 people, 500 of them get one drug, 500 of them get something else, and you tell them, you know, please come back to us 6 months from now, 1 year from now, and we'll see how you're doing. People move. Things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, people know everyone doesn't stay in Montreal. You know, their job takes them somewhere else to Ottawa, maybe, or they move away out of the country, or you know, they move house and you just cannot contact them. So loss to follow up is very common. Even the best trials, right? Like, for example, the HOPE trial was done from McMaster, and those guys are really, they're on a fantastic ship. And even their loss to follow-up is, you know, around 1%, 0.5 to 1%. So people, you know, you cannot get everyone. These people had zero loss to follow-up, run out of a small center in Spain. Like no one was lost to follow-up. When we do, which is again, you know, this is, you have to be really incredulous and to swallow all these results that they're talking about, apart from the effect size that Chris mentioned. The other thing is, for example, everyone needed to have a 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure monitoring done. Like you wear a cuff around the arm, put it around for 24 hours, do your normal work, come back. When you do 24-hour ABPM, the error rate is very high. I'm not saying it's, you know, not everyone gets it, but anywhere from 1 to 5% of the times, you just cannot, you know, get something happens, the cuff falls off, you get bad readings. These people had a zero error rate, 100% perfection. So it's like everything is so perfect in this trial that it seems to be too perfect. So that kind of leads to all the suspicion many people have had about, you know, what happened here? How come they got, you know, how come everything worked perfectly? A little bit of imperfection is very common in the best run trials. So this was why the initial suspicion came.
Another issue is adherence, right? So what do we know about how often patients do take their meds in real life, and how does it compare to what is being reported in this trial?
Exactly right. So there are many studies. So there was one study published in the BMJ, in the British Medical Journal, about 10 years prior to that. They actually looked at the adherence based on this electronic thing. So, you know, there were these pill bottles where when you opened them, it would track the fact when often the pill bottle was opened. So that was a very cool way of monitoring adherence. And what they show is that the adherence varies. No one is perfectly adherent, of course. And the patterns are interesting. So some people, you know, they occasionally forget their pills, but do take it eventually. Some people take it religiously for a few days and then just quit completely. Some people, you know, take it at different times of the day. But when you look at the morning versus the evening, it looks like, you know, people who are taking them in the morning have a greater adherence, roughly 10 to 20% better adherence than those who take in the evening. And as I was saying, it all depends on your system, right? But it looks like most people, maybe not in Spain, but in most of the parts of the world, they are happy and they're comfortable taking their pills in the morning when they wake up, or they're having their first cup of tea or coffee or what have you. So the adherence is far from perfect. And, you know, on the order of 20, 30% non-adherence is not at all uncommon. And in real life settings, it has been shown that for cardiovascular drugs, by 1 year, about half the people have stopped taking drugs completely.
Wow.
And that's very common for blood pressure. Like blood pressure is an asymptomatic disease. You are like, I feel fine. Mm-hmm. I don't feel any different taking the pill or not. So you stop taking it. Now, admittedly, in a clinical trial, these people are often more motivated. And, you know, the coordinators are calling them saying, hey, you are in this study. Are you taking your pills and stuff? So the adherence may be higher, but not perfect. These guys show almost perfect adherence to taking the pills at night versus night. Again, goes back to the too perfect story that we have been talking about throughout.
Chris, can you comment a little bit on this whole Hygieia trial versus Hygieia project? Because the authors were being questioned about this, and there might have been a mix-up involving the same name. What was going on there?
So there's basically two different research projects. There was the Hygieia project, which was a cohort study. So that's where you just follow people over time. You don't tell them what to do. And then there's the Hygieia trial, which was the randomized trial that we're talking about. And, you know, the defense that was put out when people said, you know, this doesn't look... And here's the thing, there was like very suspicious, like, you know, when these are described, they had the same number of patients in them. You know, they were recruited from the same center. So people were like, you're calling this a Hygieia trial. Is this just non-randomized data from the Hygieia project that you've published? And the authors were like, no, these are two distinct things. They just have the same name and they have the same number of patients. And that's the reality. And you're like, and it's like, you know, and I've spoken to
Hermida,
yeah. And he was like, listen, I acknowledge.
Who is that?
He's the lead author of the Hygieia trial.
Okay.
And he's like, look, no. And he's like very clear. He's like, this was a randomized trial. Look, it was unfortunate that we used the same names. He was like, I wouldn't do it again. But he's like very clear. Because sometimes you wonder, like, could this just have been like a mis... Because when you read the manuscript of the Hygieia chronotherapy trial, they never actually say the word randomized in it, right? They never actually say the word randomized. So you're like, is this just like an observational cohort, and just in the translation it was like fuzzy language? And because that would have been at least a little bit plausible. Mm-hmm. And he's very clear. He's like, these were two separate things. They're two separate patient groups. It's just that one is randomized, one is not, and they have the same name. And that's the confusion. And it's like, is that like a plausible explanation? Like it's a very hard thing to wrap your head around, because it's like you would have to, like, a lot of coincidences would have to happen for that to have been the explanation for why we got what we got.
So let me point to the elephant in the room. Yeah. Could the Hygieia trial be fraudulent? And I ask not to accuse anyone, but because, I mean, myself, I have become more and more aware of scientific fraud, especially with regards to ivermectin and COVID-19. We had Jack Lawrence and Gid MK on the show a few months ago to discuss this. And the way in which you describe this trial, it sounds, again, too good to be true. So, Dr. Hiramath, do you think that we can exclude fraud in this case or not?
We can definitely not exclude fraud. At the same time, you know, fraud is very hard to prove. Mm-hmm. Unless you have a smoking gun. And now we have a lot of circumstantial evidence, especially when it comes to the conduct of the trial, right? Like Chris mentioned randomization. I mean, I think they mentioned the word somewhere, mm-hmm. but it's very, when you mention randomization, you have to say, oh, this is how we randomized it. And this was, you know, block stratification and whatever. And there is nothing like that. You have to have a protocol about how you did things, and you don't have that available here. You should, in the analysis aspect, that's another big one, is that when you are doing a large trial, and let's say you find, you know, halfway through, people do analysis in between to see, is there a safety signal? You know, are we causing harm? And if so, then we stop. Right. But if you see a very overwhelming benefit also, then you're supposed to stop, because it's not ethical to continue anymore. You cannot deny people in the control group, you know, a benefit that you are very clearly seeing. So mm-hmm. these people, they did interim analysis. And there was, if you look at the survival curve, there was a very overwhelming benefit, but they did not stop the trial. So at best, you can say that this was very sloppy. You know, to be very charitable to them, is that, you know, maybe they mixed up the numbers and they were very sloppy in what they did and what have you. But, you know, it just doesn't pass the smell test for everything coming off as it should be. If I could just make a couple of small points, is sure. that I mentioned about the fact that high blood pressure at night causes more badness. So if we take away all the component of all the bad things that can happen, you know, from the observational data of, you know, high blood pressure is associated with bad things. If nighttime blood pressure pills could fix all of that problem, which is not plausible, but let's assume it is, what you would expect is a 30% reduction, roughly a 33% reduction. What we saw is a 65% reduction.
Wow.
You know, so you saw double the benefit that you should see if all the badness from nighttime blood pressure was wiped out, which should not happen with this drug in the first place. And again, the other one is the non-cardiovascular death, which went down. So cardiovascular death was 65%, but non-cardiovascular deaths were also down by about 40%. So cancer and trauma are the commonest cause of non-cardiovascular death. Why should blood pressure pills at night reduce cancer deaths or trauma deaths? And lastly, lowering blood pressure causes more side effects leading to lower blood pressure. So any trial in which, you know, you are able to reduce blood pressure, you see a little bit more falls, a little bit more dizziness, a little bit more lightheadedness. Now, arguably, you know, they could argue that both the groups were getting blood pressure pills. But if you are lowering blood pressure at night more, you should have lower blood pressure at night. And that's associated with there's something called open angle glaucoma or anterior optic ischemic retinopathy, where there are changes in the eyes that happen, which is reported in the eye literature to be higher with the low blood pressure at night. Hmm. And actually, this complication, they studied this, and this complication was lower, not higher, when you give blood pressure pills at night by, again, 44%. And, you know, 145 people had that, which is phenomenally higher. This is a very rare complication. So the rates were higher and there was a benefit. So everything was good, right? It's not that I can understand that something is giving a benefit, but there is a side effects that do come with, you know, intensive blood pressure lowering. And we saw nothing bad, everything, you know, everything they studied was better with the bedtime blood pressure pills.
Chris, what are your thoughts on whether the Hygieia trial might be fraudulent?
I think it is the thing. It's a very hard thing to prove, but it's hard. I mean, there's too many inconsistencies that can't be explained. Now, the journal that it was published in did do a review. There was a statement of concern for a long time on this trial. The journal did their investigation, and their final report was, well, we can't prove fraud because we don't have access to the raw data, which is what always happens when journals do investigations. But they did say, like, there were a lot of things about it that were unusual. And, you know, there was no data safety and monitoring board. So, like, an independent group that would do the interim analyses, which is, like, that's weird to not have in a randomized trial in this day and age. And they made a statement like this would not be up to standards in the modern time. But the study's not old. I mean, it was just done, you know? So it's like, it's weird that stuff like this would happen. And when stuff is weird, you have to explain it away. And so it's like, it's hard for me to see how you could have so many coincidences. Like, you know, you have two patient groups, same name, same number of patients. You do a study, you don't really use the word randomized or explain how they were randomized. It's like, it's weird, and weird isn't good. And of course now, just to bring us back to the modern day, there have been other chronotherapy trials, and there was just one presented, hasn't been published yet, but it was presented at the European Society of Cardiology, and it was the TIME trial, which also looked at chronotherapy, you know, blood pressure medication at night, bedtime versus morning, or, you know, and it didn't show a difference. So if this was true, and if this was a huge benefit, you would expect it to be consistent across multiple trials. And we haven't seen it in time. We'll have to wait for the actual publication to really dissect it properly. But right now you have different randomized data that argues against it. And when you have these types of contradictions in the literature, it usually means that there's no effect because it's not consistent.
Chris, you wrote about this whole this whole thing for Medscape, and I read in the comments section to your article a very interesting observation that reminded me of your aphorism that the best exercise is the one you enjoy doing. And the comment went, the best time for a patient to take their medication is when they will remember to do so. Dr. Hiramath, what do you make of this?
That's exactly right, right? So what I do in practice is if someone takes the pills at night and they remember to take it at night, I'm not saying it's harmful. Just because I don't believe the results of Hygieia doesn't mean that if someone is able to take that blood pressure pills at night, they shouldn't take that. But most people do remember to take that blood pressure pills in the morning. So that is what makes sense. Now, remember, as I mentioned, some people do have that nocturnal hypotension, so low blood pressure at night, which could be bad. There is some concern about, again, these are theoretical concerns, right? No one has shown that taking blood pressure pills at night is harmful necessarily. But there are concerns that if the blood pressure falls too much at night, then there could be bad things that can happen, you know, blood flowing to the heart, for example, or whatever could be an issue. So subendocardial ischemia at night. So you have to be careful about what you tell people. But if someone has a system that works for them to remember taking their pill, that's what is more important than, you know, timing of day or night or what have you.
Yeah. There's also sometimes reasons why people like to take their medications at specific times of day. And if you know what, and if that's if there's a practical reason why you need to do that, I mean, go ahead. Sometimes people like to take their medications at night because they don't want to deal with the side effects. So calcium channel blockers can cause leg swelling. And I have a lot of patients who say, you know what, I take it at night because I don't want my legs to be swollen during the day. And at night when I'm horizontal and lying in bed, it doesn't bother me as much. And it's like, okay, sure. Look, if there's a reason why, you know, why not? I mean, there's a reason why you don't want to take diuretics at night because you're probably going to be getting up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. So if there's a practical reason why you have to take a specific pill at a specific time of day, I have no objection to that as long as you remember to take it. And sometimes people, if they're taking multiple blood pressure pills, they don't want to take them all at once to prevent their blood pressure from dropping precipitously a half hour after they take their pills. They want to space them out. So they take some in the morning and some at night with their other medications. And that's fine too. So there are practical things that we can do. I mean, I think the question is from a mechanism of action standpoint, does taking blood pressure at night change something fundamental in the pathophysiology of blood pressure? And I think the answer to that, based on what we've seen so far in terms of the data, is probably no.
And I will tell our listeners also, please consult with your pharmacist before deciding to take your pills whenever, because there are certain drugs that you have to take at certain times of day, like before you've eaten, things like that. So we're not saying that take your pills whenever you want to, right?
Right. And there's interactions. Sometimes you can't take two pills at the same time. There are interactions. And that's why, well, that's why polypharmacy becomes such a problem, especially in older patients, which is a whole other topic for another day.
So one of the if I could vent a little bit, one of the frustrating aspects of this is the fact that when Hygieia came out, the results were so dramatic that it was covered, you know, on BBC, on CNN, and everyone, you know, one simple thing to reduce your risk of heart attacks by 60%, take your pills at night. The time trial was, you know, presented a couple of weeks ago. There has been hardly any coverage. You know, BBC did not cover, and CNN did not say, oh, oops, you know, that study was wrong. And that's the problem. I'm sure you've talked about this before. That's the problem with the scientific record, right? I think it was Mark Twain or someone who said, you know, by the time truth gets their boot laces tied, you know, the lies have traveled half the world. So the publicity around Hygieia and the amount of, you know, they have published a lot of papers. They are still out there. None of those papers have been retracted. So if someone who doesn't know the controversy, they look at the publication. It is a peer-reviewed publication in a highly, in a really important high-impact cardiovascular journal, the European Heart Journal. And there are many other papers. This is just one of their chronotherapy literature. They are still out there. They are corrupting, you know, if we believe the results are not true, they are out there and they are misleading people. If you do a meta-analysis, which, you know, I often do, which is you group a bunch of studies together, all these trials from them, so-called trials, will be included. So if you, unless you decide, hey, I'm deliberately going to ignore this, and how can you ignore it? How can you say, oh, I don't believe this result, hence I'm going to ignore that? That carries less weight, right? So all the editorial concern that Chris mentioned, if you read between the lines, I think they are saying that we don't believe these results, but they cannot say it. And that's why they do not withdraw the study. Similarly, there were other editorials put out. There's one by a bunch of stalwarts from Europe or hypertension key opinion leaders. And the title of the paper is, do not change your timing of bedtime drugs based on the Hygieia trial, right? It could be so emphatic and they go into the details. So they are saying, we don't believe this trial. We think it is fraudulent, but no one can publicly say that this is fraudulent because we don't have clear-cut evidence. So this paper, unlike, you know, the ivermectin and the Surgisphere stuff, which were retracted, I suspect this paper will stay out there and it will, you know, fool people into doing things which they should not be doing, which is unfortunate.
And of course, you know, if the result of a study is no difference between the two time periods, it's not as sexy as, hey, we found this one trick that will. I mean, the journalists are gonna latch onto this much more than if the result is quote unquote negative. Well, Dr. Swapnil Hiramath, thank you very much. If people want to find you and your work online, where would they go?
So the best place, of course, is Twitter. I tweet a lot, and I'm H Swapnil, so HSWAPNIL.com. HSWAPNIL on Twitter, and we also have a website called NefJC. So it's a journal club we run. A journal club is where, you know, a group of us come and discuss an article, but typically it happens in the four walls of a room. But we run a journal club on Twitter, so it's open. Anyone can see and anyone can join us. And the website where we blog about the trials that we are discussing is called nefjc.com. So www.nephjc.com.
Oh, I was going to say, you also have one of the best podcast titles.
I didn't want to mention a competitor here, but yes, we have.
So we have a
podcast called Freely Filtered. It's been around for a couple of years now, but we are nephrologists. We are kidney doctors, and the kidneys filter urine, right? So it's called Freely Filtered. It's kind of unfiltered. It's a bunch of, you know, six of us friends who gather and chat. So it's a fun podcast. It's a little bit nerdy, as most nephrologists are, but it's called Freely Filtered, and you can listen to it wherever you get your podcasts.
And we will put links to all of these in the show notes for this episode. Dr. Swapnil Hiramath, thank you very much for your time and for your expertise.
Thanks for having me.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254 0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at the body of evidence.